Did you know that 40 million of Java's population speak a distinct language that's not Javanese, and neither is it the national language Bahasa? It's Sundanese, the language that belongs to the region of West Java. And you're listening now to the work of one of its most famous literary and religious figures, the poet-preacher Haji Hassan Mustafa. Hello, I'm Margaret Coffey, with an encounter that ranges over the history of Islam and its global reach to make some very contemporary connections.
Haji Hassan Mustafa was one of the greatest Sundanese writer and poet, and we read from his work many things that are so important for the development of Indonesian culture, I think. For instance, the way he promotes Islamic values by means of Sundanese literature.
That scholar of Sundanese literature, Hawe Setiawan. At one end of this encounter's interests are figures like Hassan Mustafa, who keep on speaking out of the past. Then there's the significance of regional identity and language in amazingly culturally diverse Indonesia. And threading through all this, there's the way that Indonesian Muslims, along with Muslims elsewhere, understand and discuss just how God relates to each human being, who God is, in fact.
There are certain phrases that Muslims use that might suggest predeterminism. And, you know, certainly there is something of that.
Paul Heck has written of the common ground amongst all the differences between Christians and Muslims.
There's a statement, inshallah, if God wills it, we'll do that, right? And so, you know, you make an appointment with someone and you hear them say, sure, inshallah. And you're like, are you going to be there or not, right? And, well, it's his way of saying, yes, I'll be there, but, you know, there's a possibility that God might intervene and I won't be there, but, you know, I'll be there.
The idea of God implicit there goes back to a foundational Muslim idea of the sovereignty of God. Crucial debates in the early centuries of Islam between two philosophically different schools, the Asharites and the Mu'tazilites, focused on just what the sovereignty of God meant for human experience. How much room did it leave for human freedom? What conclusions could be drawn about the attributes of a transcendent, absolute God? 1,000 years later, in the late 18th, early 19th centuries, those debates were alive in the mind of a theologian and writer in the Egyptian city of Cairo. He was a figure called
Muhammad al-Fadali al-Shafi'i.
Peter Riddell is studying a text by this turn of the 18th century figure, a text that's used today in Pazantren, religious schools for primary and secondary aged children all over Indonesia. It's a catechism, a book describing the qualities and attributes of God, and Indonesian Muslims have been familiar with it for over 100 years. It's called
Kifayatul Awam, literally means sufficiency for the common people. What is sufficient for commoners?
Who is the God it describes? We'll come to that in a moment. But first, who was al-Fadali?
He was a significant writer in the late 18th, early 19th centuries. He got a posting at Al-Azhar University. That in itself was significant because Al-Azhar had been at that stage already arguably the most important centre of learning in the Arab world for 800 years or so. We're talking here late 1800s, and there was already a long tradition of Indonesian and Malay scholars or students going to the Middle East to study. Now, with a work such as al-Fadali's work being established in the Middle East, in Cairo, and by all accounts it was the standard text on basic principles of theology at Al-Azhar University for much of the first half of the 19th century, with Indonesian and Malay students going to study in that part of the world, inevitably they came into contact with it. The first translation into Malay was done in the 1870s, 1878, by a scholar who had been to study in Mecca. It was republished in 2009 in Malaysia, and continues to be an important text, point of reference for students in Malaysia. And equally, it found its way to Indonesia, but it's been translated into Indonesian. The copy that I've been looking at is a rendering from the 1990s. In its own foreword, the work declares that it's one of the most popular books used in pesantrens across Indonesia.
So what you're really describing there is a dynamic relationship alive for a long time. It's not as if Islam arrived, say, in the 16th century and became this characteristically Indonesian thing. This dynamic relationship continued and different influences continued to prevail.
Personally, I find that this makes the whole study of religion per se fascinating, because religions are dynamic things. They're not set in stone. They're not set in time. The relationship between Indonesia and Malaysia on the one hand and the Arab world, Mecca, Medina, Cairo, wherever, continues to evolve, because in both places there are evolutions that take place in a local sense, but they cross-fertilise as well, and even more so in the modern day with modern communications. There's two-way communication going on. And that's why, for example, when I look at the translation into Indonesian of this work today, it's not just a translation of the original Arabic. It includes a commentary. And the fact that it includes a modern commentary is a statement in itself, namely that the authors believe they have to contextualise the discussion that's in the original work and make it relevant for today.
Just around the time Al-Fadali's book describing the attributes of God was making its way from Cairo to Southeast Asia and Indonesia, Haji Hasan Mustafa was making his way home from Mecca, where he'd been a student, to his hometown in West Java.
Hasan Mustafa, or more commonly known as Haji Hasan Mustafa, was born in about 1852 in Garut, which is one of the areas of the province of West Java in contemporary Indonesia. And it's in the area occupied by the Sundanese ethnic group. Indonesia has very many ethnic groups, and the Sundanese are the second biggest after the Javanese of those ethnic groups. And what does that mean to say they're Sundanese? Well, the biggest manifest difference is language, really. People who regard themselves as Sundanese speak the language of Sundanese, which distinguishes them from their Javanese brothers and sisters. At the same time, though, all Sundanese are also fluent speakers of Indonesian as well, the national language.
Which is not Javanese.
Which is not Javanese. No, that's right. So we have this strong distinction between the national language, Indonesian, and the regional languages such as Sundanese, Javanese, Balinese, Madurese, and so on.
And are they mutually intelligible? Could a Sundanese who's a non-Javanese speaker understand Javanese in any way?
Well, generally, no. No. The exception is, of course, a lot of people are mobile nowadays, so they might be brought up in Bandung, the capital city of West Java, but then spend a bit of time working, say, in Semarang or Surabaya when they would be within a Javanese-speaking milieu. And in that sense, they would have some understanding of Javanese. But really, no, they're not readily intelligible to members of the other ethnic groups.
Dr. Julian Milley teaches in the Department of Anthropology at Monash University. It's not only language, he says, that distinguishes West Java from what's referred to as Java.
Each of the regions had traditional elites. They had families who occupied positions in authority structures that had obviously dated back a very long time. And the Sundanese had such a structure as well. In the Javanese areas, these traditional elites maintained their authority throughout the colonial period and into the present as well, whereas that didn't happen in West Java. None of the Sundanese local elites survived the independence period, and they haven't held any significant authority since independence. And that's made a big difference, particularly in the Islamic atmospheres, if you like, of these two ethnic groups. The Sundanese people tend to have a more prominent sense of Islam in the public sphere than Java. And a large part of that is because these traditional elites had their own concepts of charisma, cosmological concepts, which were all Islamic, but in ways that were very much inflected by this background of these long histories of these families of the Sultan and so forth. Whereas in West Java, because there weren't those centres of these traditional authorities with their conventional ideas of cosmology and so forth, Islam had a broader uptake in that part of the world than it did in Java. So you quite often find nowadays Islamic communities in the West Java tend to be more pious, perhaps more ready to accept that the public sphere should be Islamic, in perhaps sometimes a literal way, than the communities in Java.
Was it not also the crucible for important Islamic movements earlier in the 20th century?
There have been a number in West Java. The one that's most prominent was the Darul Islam movement, which was a rejection of the authority of the new Republican government. And it commenced in the late 40s, which was the time Indonesia emerged as an independent nation. But it really kept on going till the middle of the 1960s. And that movement achieved terrific support in a number of parts of West Java. The goal there was establishment of an Islamic state for Indonesia. I mean, that was a battle that was never going to be won, but it was terribly costly.
So that's the environment that formed Haji Hasan Mustafa, the poet and religious scholar who wrote these verses set to music. It's in the form of a particular kind of tembang music. Thanks to Hawe Setiawan for this information and to Tito Ambio for the recitation.
Kudu lawung pada lawung, sajajaran da pancakaki, gumelar lebah alamna, maju teing mundur teing, matak sarosopan rasa, pinggan diantep jempiring. We must gather together, making a single line of our genealogies, so that they move forward and then right back, in their right seasonal order, to produce a myriad sensations. Flat plates are stacked with the curved bowls.
He had a remarkable life. He was a member of a privileged class and he was able to obtain an education. So it would have consisted of studying with teachers from a very young age, doing courses in Islamic schools, what we call pesantren in Indonesia, not only in West Java, but also in Java. Still as a young man, he was sent to Mecca, and he ended up spending about 13 years in Mecca in 2 stays. So that sort of, in a way, defined him because he, of course, became an alim or religious authority as a result of that experience.
There's a long and complex story, too, of Mustafa's connection with the Dutch colonial government and his appointment via Dutch patronage as the head religious official in the West Java city of Bandung. But the key point here is the way Mustafa, for all his Meccan studies, connected with his own Sundanese culture and communicated that to his own people.
Religious leaders like Mustafa also had a role as preachers. And in that role, of course, they reached far larger audiences because these people would be invited to speak at all kinds of events, not just pedagogical ones, but if someone is married and the marriage is being celebrated with a marriage celebration, then it's customary to invite a preacher to come to give a sermon at the celebration. Circumcisions are the same. Various stages, for example, of the pregnancy are celebrated in this or that way. So in that sense, a preacher could reach quite large audiences at that time through his role as a person who's frequently invited to all kinds of events. Later in his life, in the Bandung phase of his life, he did also attract a following attracted to his charisma. He had people known who were known to be his secretaries who would then follow him round and actually record his speeches, his sermons.
What sort of figure emerges from all of these writings?
Certainly a contrarian. He seemed to like being in opposition to the structures of Islamic authority in West Java. And there are a number of stories about things he did that appear to be deliberately designed to provoke people. A major part of his work is his use of metaphors and figurative language uses that he took from Sundanese culture. Plants, parts of plants, trees, agricultural produce, agricultural patterns of behaviour and so forth. He used these as metaphors for describing Islamic concepts that, in fact, he had encountered during his time in Mecca. So these were concepts that will be recognised throughout the Islamic world. But, of course, once you start to describe a theological schema in the various parts of the coconut in Sunda, in similar societies, all the different parts of a coconut are known with a different word. And at different stages of the fruit's life as well, the names change. So the young coconut before it becomes a fruit, when it's a bud and so forth, There's an amazing rich lexicon. And Mustafa would use this rich lexicon then to present an Islamic system that was really rich in its use of Sundanese images. And that, I think, inevitably brought him into contact with a lot of authority figures for whom the containment of Islamic knowledge in fairly rigidly defined disciplines and forms and books and so forth was a very important part of maintaining religious authority. I mean, it wouldn't be very good if religious knowledge could be seen to spill out in all directions and all kinds of languages and to be used in whatever way that one wanted. But that appeared to be what Mustafa was quite keen on. He was very keen on Sundanese Muslims not considering themselves to be under the domain of narrowly defined forms of religious authority. He appeared to want them to be experiencing it in all kinds of ways.
Which is why, says Hawe Setiawan, the memory of Haji Hassan Mustafa remains alive in West Java. He signifies the riches of Sundanese culture and a way of being Muslim that is attractive to people. Apologies, by the way, for the poor sound on the telephone line to Bandung.
This is the most important point, I think. Contemporary people who are interested in Mustafa, seems to have something to do to the way Islam is known here, like in cultural root here in our lives. We need to refresh, we need to redevelop our way in expressing Islam in a good way. We don't need bomb, we don't need jihad propaganda. We need expressing Islam in a fine and good way, just like Mustafa.
Julian Milley has been working with Hawe Setiawan on a translation of Hassan Mustafa's book, a book called Exposition on the Stages of Islamicness.
Hawe and I have been translating this book by Mustafa for a number of years now, and as we've come across certain passages, Hawe frequently struck by their relevance to contemporary polemics in West Java. So it's quite often for him to then excerpt what we've been translating and send it out on his own blog, and people seem to read it immediately and respond. This was a work that apparently was published first in 1899, but it was published in book form not until 1937. And what he does is he sets out seven stages of Islamicness. So it's a journey commencing with a Muslim who is very much part of a social environment in which everybody else is Muslim. And it ends in the seventh stage of a person who has managed to break free from the social constraints that are implied by living in a society like that. The first three or four stages are a dialogue between the left and the right. The left side is influenced by, under the influence of Iblis, of the devil, and the right side is under the influence of divinity. The left side, Iblis, encourages the speaker to remain within the safe confines of the social structures of religion, to not depart from them, to just resign yourself to Islam as a pattern of living that's really well ingrained in this culture and which doesn't require too much effort. Whereas the voice of divinity from the right urges Mustafa instead to attempt at all times to break free from those. And then the way to break free becomes this engagement with concepts that are very well known in the canon of Islamic knowledge.
Here's one way that Mustafa engages with these Islamic concepts.
The Muslim declaration of faith, the creedal statement of Muslims, which is there is no divinity other than Allah and Muhammad is his messenger. How can I have the nerve to testify for so long that there is no deity other than Gusti Allah? What if someone asks me, how do you know? Maybe I'll only be able to answer with, because the old people said so, because my father said so. But how could one believe this? How can testimony rely on talk alone? So you can see how this is sort of putting him in conflict with the bearers of religious authority. Because of this, I will persist in warning that I will not fail in my wish to get real proof. For instance, I've been asked, how do you know what a chili looks like? I replied, of course I know, for I've tasted that it's spicy. Do you know sugar? I replied, of course, because I've tasted that it's sweet. Do you know salt? I replied, of course I know, because I've tasted it's salty. I don't answer, my father told me. A lot of it is about pushing clear meaning to the side as opposed to arguing for clear meanings. So, and of course, this is one of the things that attracts people to mysticism, that that it doesn't offer the clear resolutions of meaning or clear definitions, but offers many.
And that sets him at an interesting variance from Muhammad Al-Fadali, the scholar whose book travelled to Indonesia around the same time Mustafa returned home. Muhammad Al-Fadali's book sets up a system that makes it easier for students to learn some core Islamic ideas about God. Back to Peter Riddell, who, by the way, is Dean of the Melbourne School of Theology and an adjunct professor at Monash University.
It begins with general statements about God's sovereignty, and it then leads into a presentation of the attributes of God, which number 41, and it goes through and presents them in categories, divided into 20 positive attributes, 20 negative attributes. By positive, I mean attributes that are necessary for God. By negative attributes, I mean attributes which cannot be applied to God. And then one possible attribute. And that is the power to create good or evil whenever he wishes. He has the power to do so, and it's possible for him to do so, but he doesn't have to do so at a given moment.
Why does that remain a possibility and not a conclusion?
I think that speaks into the debate I was talking about before, because that was one of the big charges of the Mu'tazilite rationalists, that God necessarily had to be good. He necessarily had to do good things and create good. Whereas for the scripturalists, who really resolved the debate and became the normative authority in Islam, they were reluctant to enforce such a constraint on God, and therefore they left that as a possibility for God to do as he saw fit. Ultimately, it leaves the sovereignty up to God on that particular score.
It's interesting because defining a whole series of attributes, it concretizes God, doesn't it, rather than the idea of being unable to describe that which is God.
This kind of approach used by Muhammad Fadali, it was speaking into another debate, of course, the debate between, I guess, Sufi and more non-Sufi approaches to understanding God, where the Sufi approaches, especially in their most extreme, spoke very much in terms of abstracts. So by responding to that, Muhammad al-Fadali was giving very concrete expressions of the shape of God, of the nature of God, of the attributes of God, so that individual Muslims could not only understand the shape of God, but also especially understand their duty to acknowledge God's sovereignty and to follow his law.
On ABC Radio National, this is Encounter, with the story of a conversation about God within Indonesian culture. Don't forget you can return to this program at any time on abc.net.au/rn. Just locate Encounter and check out the audio and the transcript. And do leave a comment in the comments box. It's helpful to know what you think about our programs. Let's go back to those debates that Peter Riddell described as debates Muhammad al-Fadali was speaking into. No matter that one of them dates right back to the 9th and 10th centuries. First, there was the debate about what God consists of. And then there was the debate as to the merits of Sufism as a way of approaching God. Remember that al-Fadali was working at Al-Azhar University in Cairo. And it so happens at a significant turning point in Middle Eastern relations with Europe.
The French invasion had happened in 1798. He died in 1821, so he would have felt it very keenly, though we have no record of his response to that particular event. Of course, the arrival of the French meant the arrival of the British, the sea battles outside Alexandria and so forth. He was conscious of that. Having said that, while the arrival of the colonial powers signalled a whole new level of, I suppose, focus for Islamic writers responding to the challenge of non-Muslim colonial powers, they also lived on with a legacy of previous rivalries and conflicts within Islam. So his writing doesn't specifically respond to the arrival of the French or the British. In terms of the work I'm looking at, it more focuses on old rivalries and old disputes within Islam. So he's still speaking into a debate that began in the 800s.
And that's the debate between the Mu'tazilites and the Asharites, those two schools of thinking about the nature of God.
At several points of the work, he specifically refutes a particular school of writers from the 800s who argued for free will, for example, or who argued that God must necessarily be just. God could not be unjust. Now, he argues against that school. So that's looking backwards, reflecting a historical debate. At the same time, we're seeing new debates emerge with the arrival of the colonial powers when Muslim writers, the modernist school based in Egypt, began asking the question, why have Muslims come under the control of non-Muslims? What have we done that God would allow this to happen? And the answer they came up with was that we haven't been good enough Muslims. We've left the requirements of our faith, and therefore we need to get back to our faith, get back to the basics in a sense. So that debate assumed its most crystallized form after him. He died in 1821, and the big center of the modernist debate was around 1900. But he was there as an early forerunner of that. To some extent, his arguments fed into that debate as well.
This is how Peter Riddell describes the diverging camps in the thousand-year-old argument about God.
There were fundamentally two schools of thought. The Mu'tazilites, one could characterize as rationalists, freer thinkers, I suppose. And the other school, the Ahlul Hadith, or the family of the Hadith, or the scripturalists. The Mu'tazilite rationalists, they argued that by definition God was just, God was fair, God was equitable, and God necessarily was just. In other words, God could not predetermine a particular group of people to sin and then punish them for that sin. That would not be just. The more literalist school, who adhered very closely to a literal reading of Scripture, well, really they asked a question, who are we, mere humans, mere creatures, to question God's justice? If we don't understand God's justice, that merely points to our lack of understanding rather than a flaw in the divine. So their response was, we should not have this conversation. You rationalists should stop putting boundaries on God's action and accept that some things are beyond our understanding. And they had a particular phrase to explain it, bila kaifa. Literally means without asking how. And it was that school that effectively won the debate, and that came to define the shape of Islam as it evolved in succeeding centuries. The dominant school was one that accepted that God was absolute. There was a large measure of predeterminism. God was necessarily in control, and that was right.
There's a catch here in the idea of predeterminism. It's an idea that demands clarification. I've heard the idea put to Peter Riddell in a university seminar that John Calvin, the 16th century Protestant reformer and apostle of predestination, could have been influenced by Islam.
Yeah, I don't think it's a realistic idea, but people are looking for ways to connect at this global and globalizing moment. I think for our own interests, we need to see how we're invested in one another's lives. And so I think perhaps sometimes the intention can be noble, you know, to show we have the same theological dilemmas, we have the same philosophical questions, you know, to show that we're in the same boat, as it were. And I think in many respects we are. But sometimes these comments, I think they neglect the facts of history, including theological history, to show that Muslims, Christians, Jews, other people are part of a common human venture.
In fact, there's a crucial theological difference between Calvin's concept of predestination and the Islamic idea espoused by the Asharites. What's at issue here, explains Paul Heck, is God's nature and not human worth.
It wasn't so much a question of a predestined choice of certain individuals for salvation. So it's very different from some of the Christian discussions of the Reformation in the 16th century, where they would have said that God has chosen certain people in advance for his grace and for his salvation, and he hasn't chosen other people. So those debates in 16th century Europe were about the value of human nature as opposed to divine grace. Here, the point was the justice of God. Is God just, and what does that mean? The Mu'tazili school said, we have to understand the justice of God. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to function in society. So, for example, how do I know that what I'm doing is favorable to God? They said that things are just because the human mind knows they're just. Things are good or bad because the human mind knows they're good or bad. And so in that sense, it's a question of God's justice. If I don't know what I'm doing is good or bad, how can I be judged for it on Judgment Day by God? Is God just or not? Now, the Asharis, the other school of thought, would certainly have agreed that God is just. But they wouldn't have agreed that humans determine the justice of God, okay? They would have said that God determines what's good or bad, and God determines what's just or unjust. Even if humans don't fully understand the ways of God, they have to accept the ways of God. The first school, the Mu'tazilites, were much more in favor of the idea of free will. And so they're really trying, that second school of thought, the Asharis, are really trying to preserve the sovereignty of God. The first school of thought was trying to preserve the justice of God. That second school, the Asharis, they even went so far to say that God creates human acts. We don't even create our own acts. And, you know, as I mentioned before, the Mu'tazilites saw that as abhorrent. Does God also create our unjust acts? And therefore, that makes God unjust. So all of these were very complex debates.
How did the second school allow a sphere for individual, for personal responsibility?
I'm not sure, first of all, that that was their primary concern. But just to put it in a different sense, when they say that God creates the acts, does that mean God makes automatons out of us? We're just puppets in the hands of God? Maybe that's what some of them meant. But I think at another level, when they say that God creates our acts, they're saying that it's God that determines the moral worth of our acts. It's not the human mind that determines the moral worth of acts. In that sense, what the Asharites wanted to say is that salvation is in God's hands. The Mu'tazilites almost were saying that humans are the agents of their own salvation, voluntarily through their own volition. They do good, bad, justice, or injustice. And so they're the ones who determine whether they're saved or damned. The Asharites wanted to say that the agency of salvation is Allah, is God. And so they wanted to say that, look, even someone who does bad acts could be saved by God. We can't understand God's ways. And so even though on one hand it seems like they were just talking about humans as automatons, right, that God creates their acts, I think at a deeper level they were also saying that, look, God could be merciful.
Paul Heck there. And that deeper level of meaning is the idea to hold on to, the idea that God could be powerful and merciful. And it takes us to human responsibility.
Now, okay, where did they allow room for human freedom? It's very complex. There's this thing called capacity. Do you have agency? Do you have capacity? The term in classical Arabic was qudra. Now, to get around this, to ensure that God is the creator of everything, the Asharites said that at every moment you act, God is creating at the same time an agency, a capacity, a qudra. Qudra, capacity, agency to create things, to do things, that's something that's not in human nature. Okay, that you don't have this capacity by your human nature, because that would somehow make you a partner with God in the causal nexus of the universe. God is the only cause, right? But what they're saying is that at the same time as you, or just as you're doing something, God also creates the capacity to allow you to do that. So it's a way for them to, as it were, have their cake and eat it too, to preserve the sovereignty of God, that God creates everything, your acts, and even your capacity to do those acts, and yet it shoulders the responsibility on humans, because just when you're doing that act, you're given the capacity by God. So at every instant that you do something, you're given the capacity to do that act.
So how was Islamic, I suppose, normative doctrine on these themes resolved, and over what period? I suppose, can it be said to have ever been finally resolved?
Yeah, no, these debates still go on, of course, and they do tie into the attributes of God, right? Particularly the divine speech of God. These things were heavily debated in the 8th and 9th and 10th and 11th centuries. and really right up into the Ottoman period. And today, you know, Muslims will debate these things, but I would say that they're not so much front and center today. The debates in Islam today are more about whether Sufism is legitimacy, the idea of reverencing a spiritual figure, a saint. Salafi groups in Islam would say that that's polytheism, whereas Sufi groups would say they're not worshiping those saints, but those saints are guiding them or helping them or even interceding for them. So those are the big debates today, you know, over what is true monotheism.
Paul Heck, author of Common Ground, Islam, Christianity and Religious Pluralism. And he's the founder also of the Centre for the Study of Religions Across Civilizations at Georgetown University. And with that remark about the debates today circling around the legitimacy of Sufism and what is true monotheism, he brings us back to Indonesia and the living influence of those two historic figures, Muhammad al-Fadali and Haji Hasan Mustafa. As Julian Milley explained, there is a clear connection between Hasan Mustafa and al-Fadali, just in the focus of their thinking and writing. His own research interest is in Hasan Mustafa.
The connection with al-Fadali is quite clear, mainly through this theological construct that answers the question of, well, what is Allah made of? What does God consist of? And Mustafa used the idea of the attributes with great attention to Sundanese tradition. So that's a very strong connection between they both use this same idea, but in quite different ways.
But you use the words plasticity and mediation to describe his work. So it has quite a different character from al-Fadali's work itself, which has a kind of rigorous quality about it, doesn't it?
I agree. It's like they're heading in opposite directions. One is quite a consolidating, trying to make a strict definition that will probably be argued against other definitions, while on Mustafa's part, he really is opening it up to so many interpretations and to a lot of vagueness, which he definitely thought was a positive attribute, the idea that words could have multiple meanings, or that meanings could change over time, or that people should be involved in comparing meanings. This was very common for him, so I agree there.
Julian Milley. On the other hand, Peter Riddell has been studying al-Fadali.
Al-Fadali, as I say, he speaks into quite a number of debates, but he speaks into a specifically Indonesian question today. There are tensions in modern Indonesia between forces for international Islamic resurgence and more traditionalist forces that are more Sufi inclined in parts of Southeast Asia. Al-Fadali's, I suppose, more literalist approach to the faith doesn't really lend itself to easily to complex Sufi theologies. It lends itself today to one side of a debate that's becoming increasingly vocal in Indonesia.
Does the commentary in your text enhance that aspect of his work?
Yes, it does. I mean, the commentary emphasises the points he's making. So, for example, in his work, if he refers to the rationalists, the Mu'tazilite rationalists, in highly critical terms, as he does, the commentary explains more about the Mu'tazilite rationalists, just so that the Indonesian readers understand who they were and what their arguments were, but then equally supports the criticism of them as well. That is relevant for today in another way, in that the rationalist school that was represented by these 8th century thinkers has had a resurgence among more liberal wings of Islamic thinking around the world, and it's shown itself in Indonesia. There's one particular set of sermons which I was looking at recently where the whole question of free will and predestination was addressed. Al-Fadali's approach is essentially predestinarian. The sermon I was looking at quite skillfully argues for a fairly balanced approach between the two.
So in Indonesia, the discussion remains three-cornered. As Peter Riddell remarked, the revival of Mu'tazilite emphasis on applying human reason to religious themes has been an important strand in modern Indonesian religious thought. Think of a figure like the late Nurholish Majid. But the main discussion is going on in a wider field, among the broad Muslim public, and not just among the intellectuals. And that's also in the field of the dominant school of Islamic thinking, the Asharite school.
The Sufi thing is much more in line with the Ashari, because the Sufis, they give a spiritualized understanding of this theology. They want to say that they have detached themselves from the world, and they've even detached themselves from their own will, such that it's only God that's acting through them, right? I mean, for the good, you know, so that it's not just when they're in the mosque praying, but it's at every moment of their life where God is working through them. It might seem a little bit ironic, but in fact, Sufism is, as it were, the spiritual counterpart to the Ash'ari theology that emphasizes the action of God through human beings. Now, you know, I get a lot of Muslim students in my classes who ask about this, and, you know, they're like their Christian counterparts. The Christian counterparts, for them, the debate is more, have I been chosen by God for a special grace or not, right? I mean, the debate is, does human nature have any worth in the eyes of God? If it doesn't, then your salvation depends entirely not on your human nature and what your human nature can do, but whether God has chosen you in advance for his grace. And so that's coming out of some of the Calvinist positions. And so, you know, Christians have those concerns. Christian youth debate those things, but it's a very different theological history. The Muslim youth, though, they ask me these questions. There's something very basic in Islam. It's called al-qada wal-qadar. So God's determining of things and destiny, it connects with this notion in Islam that God wrote everything in advance. Some people consider this to be the sixth pillar of Islam. So this is not part of one theological school or another. Of course, it gets interpreted in different ways. But, you know, every Muslim youth, along with the idea of praying and fasting and pilgrimage and zakat, almsgiving, they would know this. And so they come up to me and they say, how can we understand this? Are we just, you know, automatons? Is this God? God has just written all our acts in advance? Now, the way that this is treated today is in this sense, that God's foreknowledge of what we do, of what all humans will do over the course of human history, precedes his act of determining, of writing down all those things in his book of history, let's call it, okay? And so, for example, he knew that I would freely choose to become an academic before he determined it. In fact, he knew that I would do something out of my own free will before he wrote it in the acts of human history, as it were.
I'm wondering if Christians today, whether in some quarters too much is made amongst them of predestination in the Muslim sense.
They elevate a little bit the idea that Muslims are all about predestination. There are certain phrases that Muslims use that might suggest predeterminism. And, you know, certainly there is something of that. And I don't know, perhaps that can be a function of certain social political conditions where maybe there is a certain fatalism when you're faced with an authoritarian regime, or where you're a bright young Muslim student at a university, but in your society you can't get anywhere unless you have what's called a wasta, someone who will be a connection for you to get a job in a government. You realize that you're an authoritarian regime, you're in a social system where, you know, your merits don't seem to matter. And so, yeah, there are certain Muslim phrases. It's maktub, it's written, you know. But that doesn't, I would suggest, undermine a Muslim activism. I mean, we're seeing in the Arab Spring that Muslims are taking their political destiny into their own hands. There's a lot of obstacles along the way. But here's an example. When the opportunity is there, they take it. And there's a real Western misjudgment of this, but it's not to say that it's not there to some extent.
In the same vein, back in West Java, Mustafa is a figure invoked in shaping the political future.
It is amazing the way that Mustafa is recalled in some debates that, in fact, are quite important in West Java at this point in time. So although he's not a person who studied, that's absolutely correct, or really remembered on a large scale, in some debates that are going on now, he's becoming important. Contemporary West Java has been the site of a number of ongoing disputes of religious conflict, both within the Muslim community and also between religions. One of the most prominent that has been ongoing has been some pressure and threats that have been brought to bear on the Ahmadiyya minority. And of course, these have created some debate in West Java and Indonesia. And it's interesting that Mustafa's name is and some of his teachings are recalled. So there is one lecturer who works in Tasikmalaya in West Java, Asep Salahuddin, who has published quite a number of newspaper articles around these ongoing debates. And for him, Mustafa's very locally oriented Islamic mediations are very important in this debate because he uses the symbol of the charuluk. The charuluk is a kind of food that comes from the aren palm tree. And what he does with the idea of the charuluk is to say, look, Sundanese people have developed a way of living in harmony. We have to be careful then about these traditions. And in Asep Salahuddin's feeling, these traditions arrive from outside of West Java. What he's referring to is the idea that there is one universally correct interpretation of being Muslim, of what is required of Muslims. And Salahuddin then uses Mustafa's writing deliberately to say, look, we don't need those forces from outside, which appear to encourage disturbance.
Hawe Setiawan is a scholar in the Centre for Sundanese Studies. He's involved in many aspects of Sundanese cultural life, and one way he communicates ideas about Sundanese culture to the broader public is via a monthly column in a local newspaper. He also has children to whom he tries to communicate the value of rich regional cultures in the building up of the Indonesian nation.
I tell them that we live in the global world with different people, with different culture, languages, and we have our own language, our own culture, and we can contribute to the togetherness by expressing ourselves in fine way. It's like Mustafa expressing Islam in his fine way. Mustafa writes and authoritative works on the customs and culture of Sundanese people. This work is important to be read by school children, actually. My wife and I try hard to read this kind of works to tell something to our children here for the benefit of their development as part of this nation, this great nation.
Indonesian scholar Hawe Setiawan, who's working with Julian Milley from Monash University on the translation of a book of writings by Haji Hassan Mustafa.
This passage, for example, was one of the ones that was passed on by Hawe. The text talks about people who are bigoted in this. It says, "The Lord who we worship widely smiles in his singularity here. Wow, I've warned you about squabbles over the correct object of worship. It's the fault of those who are busy in the world of observance. And as a result, you wear your shoes on the wrong feet. Each of you argues for their own correctness. I am right and you are wrong, not realizing that your accusations are nonsense and that even you yourself could be accused."
Hawe Setiawan kindly provided the recording you heard of a beautiful performance in Bandung in 1994 of Mustafa's poetry. The singers were Tajuddin Niwan and Neneng Dinar. You heard also in this program Paul Heck, Julian Milley and Peter Riddell. My thanks to them for their work in putting me in touch with people and ideas and translations. And there's further information about their work and their writing at abc.net.au/rn. Just locate Encounter. There you can listen again to the program, read a transcript, and make a comment. We'd like to hear from you. Technical production by Brendan O'Neill. I'm Margaret Coffey.